So I love to, as I've probably talked about some here, kind of dig into some of the details of the suttas, the Buddhist, the early Buddhist teachings. And, I'm mentoring in a mindfulness teacher training program right now, and I was looking at the applications of the students today, and many of them say things like, oh, I got really inspired when I read Pema Chodron or Jack Kornfield. And like them, I too was really introduced to Buddhism through Western teachers and kind of Western interpretations or understandings of the Dharma. And we're fortunate to be have so many doorways into learning and so many different voices. But after a while, I like many other people got curious to know exactly what the Buddha said about certain things, and so you kind of you read a few different teachers and you see that there are kind of like different takes on things, and you start going, well, what is it really? And if you go on a retreat and you're meditating a lot, then you really get confused. In a way, I think retreats can do that. It's all of a sudden, it's not something that's just written down on paper or sort of diagram for you that makes sense. Oh yeah, you just pay attention to your breath, and when your mind wanders, you come back. Great, I'll do that. And like, a few days into it, you're like, where's my mind? Where's my body? Where's my breath? Eventually you find it. But that kind of tends to draw you, that kind of a deepening experience into this curiosity, and so that's what kind of has motivated a lot of my practice and study and teachings for some time now. So the in the Theravada tradition, which is where insight meditation comes from, the kind of key teaching is called the Satipatthana Sutta, and it's the teaching on mindfulness, which again makes it so relevant because this is such a widespread topic, and there are so many books by people, and I read books, or I don't read them, I'll glance at them. I might look at the table of contents or a page, and it's pretty evident that the person who's written the book has never even read the Satipatthana Sutta. You kind of go, oh, well, not that you have to in order to understand mindfulness or to say something useful about it, but in any case, I want to go and look at that. And so you get into these teachings, and they're coming out of this ancient culture from a dead language that's being translated. Originally, it was translated by a bunch of English colonists who had never meditated in their lives back in the 19th century, probably. And now we have modern translations, but they're trying to take these words that we don't have English words for. Sati itself, S-A-T-I, we translate it as mindfulness. It's like, how can a four-letter word mean mindfulness? It's got to have... So a lot of time can be spent on just the details of it. And, as a former English major, I find words interesting. So that also sort of drives me. So I've been looking at the person who's viewed as the greatest contemporary scholar and master on this topic is the Venerable Analio, the German Buddhist monk. And I have just two of his books with me. He's one of these people who cranks them out. You have to, it's hard to keep up. And his latest book, well, this is the kind of the breakthrough one. It's called Satipatthana, the Direct Path to Realization, where he goes through this sutta that's about 10 pages long and writes a 250-page book, 300-page book, taking it apart word by word. And then this is called Satipatthana Meditation, a practice guide, where he takes the everything that's in the sutta, and then tries to and it sort of tries to pull out what he sees as the key ways to meditate with it. So, as I say, it's hard to keep up with him. And I've just started in on this newer book, and I don't read books like that quickly. I often find myself kind of spellbound by a couple of pages that I keep kind of going back and reflecting on. And so I got caught on this section where he's talking about internal and external mindfulness. And it's one of those lines that shows up in the suttas. Well, let me see if I can find the line in the sutta. I think the sutta is in this book. Yeah. So there are four, we call them foundations of mindfulness, four areas of mindfulness: the body, feelings, mind states, and dhammas or phenomena. And even defining all those four, particularly the last three, takes some time. I'm not going to go into all that right now. But this is, so this is a part of the sutta that he calls the refrain. In this way, in regard to the body, he, meaning a meditator, so a monk in this case, he abides contemplating the body internally, or he abides contemplating the body externally, or he abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. Clear as mud, right? You abide contemplating the body internally and the body externally. So one of the things that he does in this book, and that I really appreciate about Anālya, is that he doesn't just tell you what he thinks. He also refers to other teachers, and he'll refer to ancient commentaries, but he'll refer to also contemporary teachers and kind of say, well, this is the different views. So he's giving this very broad view and really comes to it with a lot of open-mindedness. And he shows how there are some people who interpret this as meaning that you're aware of your inner, the feelings inside your body and the feelings outside your body. Like you feel your skin, and that would be external. And you feel maybe your lungs moving, that would be internal. And he's like, yeah, I don't think that's quite what it means. And then he goes through a few of these different ideas, one of which is externally means that you have psychic powers where you're reading other, like when it gets to externally being aware of mind states, it'd be externally that I can read your mind. You know? He's like, yeah, I don't think, not so much. But he also sort of nods to those things and saying, yeah, there's something to that. But he gets to essentially saying that what externally being aware, being mindful externally, is to be aware of other people. And so that's a lot of what I want to talk about. And first I want to just quote what he says about just being internally. He says, awareness applied only internally can lead to self-centeredness. One can become excessively concerned with what happens with and within oneself, while at the same time remaining unaware of how one's action and behavior affect others. I think that's a very reasonable statement, and it certainly doesn't just apply to meditators. Also seems to apply to certain political leaders, but we won't go into that. This struck me that this is one of the things as we start to practice, this can be kind of one of the little stumbling blocks. And there are kind of, you know, stages to meditation practice. You get started, and at first your thoughts are driving you crazy, and And then you finally kind of like, oh, I don't have to be bothered by my thoughts. And but one of the things that can happen is that we become sort of ultra sensitized to our inner experience, and then we can become very annoying. You know? We can be, because everything isn't the way we want it to be. Everything's not affecting. We're not feeling the way we want to feel all the time. And so our external version of that is the external world should change so that my internal world can be comfortable. Right? Now, when this sort of reminded me, as I was reflecting on this, of an experience I had more than once, where I came back from retreat feeling, as one does, kind of very uplifted and very aware of myself. And I remember one time particularly, my wife, she was my girlfriend at the time, picking me up at the airport, and we were going to go to a party. And I'm coming back from retreat, I'm all opened up, and I'm like, we never made it to the party. Because, like, I said something which was, like, just not at all what she needed to hear. And her reaction was, like, not acceptable to me. And within, you know, half an hour of coming back from this 10-day retreat and being all enlightened, I'm, like, yelling at my girlfriend. I'm like, oops, something is not right here, you know. And it was very much that, just being really concerned with my inner experience and expecting the world to kind of conform to it, you know. Well, I'm mellow now, you know, and so everybody else should be mellow, you know. And it's true that one of the real challenges of practice, when we begin and start to get deeper into practice, is that we can get very opened up. And we don't realize that, and we don't yet know how to balance that with kind of protecting ourselves, you know, first of all, you know, to just not take in the external so much. But then further, to start to realize, oh, that this is, that I need to really look at that, be more attentive to the external world. So a few examples of this. I'm taking as part of this mentorship that I'm being a mentor. We had kind of training in multiculturalism, diversity, and one of the ideas that was brought up was the difference between intention that we have when we say something and the impact that it has to the person who's hearing it. And of course, this was particularly around sensitivity around racial issues and diversity issues, but it's relevant in all our interactions, right? That and you know, who has never said something like, "Oh, I meant that to be a joke," you know, when someone got upset. I mean, as someone who's trained in sarcasm by my entire family, you know, I've often found myself in that position where I thought I was saying something funny. My intention, as far as I was aware of my intention, was to have fun, and the impact was completely different. So again, the internal, this is a really good example of seeing the difference between the internal and the external, and how important it is to ask ourselves, is my intention going to align with the impact? Is the impact of this going to be really what I think, what my intention is with it? So a couple places where it's interesting to start to kind of practice or notice how what the external means, or how we kind of become aware of the external. Before the first time I went on a long retreat, a friend who was also a teacher suggested to me, he said, if you have a chance during the retreat to sit in front and to look at everybody, like if they need a bell ringer or someone to lead the chanting, do that. And then while you're meditating, like look at everybody. I was like, can I do that? Am I a hero? It's like, no. And this, so I'm on this long retreat, and it's several weeks into it before I got the opportunity to do this. So I'm sitting up there in front of a big, you know, there's like 100 people sitting, and you know, it's silent. It's, you know, we're in this quiet center, and everybody's really settled in. And I kind of open my eyes and take a peek, and it's not what it sounded like. There's a lot of movement, very subtle movements going on. People shifting posture, people rocking, people scratching, seeing people's faces. There's a tremendous amount we can read from people's faces. And it was kind of a shock that, oh, there's actually a lot going on. And that I could see a lot of what was going on for people. And it wasn't psychic. It's just that you can read that. So the, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Paul Ekman, who has studied facial expressions in all across human culture, and has found the template for different feelings that are expressed in the face. It's really interesting. If you ever get to look at it, you can, I'm sure, look it up online, where they show different expressions and how, you know, just, and that they're universal. That, you know, that's anger, right? We recognize it right away. That's sadness. And one of the things that's interesting, he says, most people can't fake it. They can't really fake these things. It just comes through. He said, actors are the only people who can just, they can, without having the emotion, they can completely project the feelings. But I think that, so I think we all have a capacity, if we are attentive, to kind of see what's going on in people if we pay attention. And this, and the fact that the Buddha is saying you should do that is a good clue, right? That actually, yeah, it's part of our practice. It's that our practice isn't really fulfilled if we don't look at each other and pay attention to people. And you know, when you think about it, I mean, that's, in some sense, that's one of the ways that compassion arises, is that we pay attention to other people. It's also true that compassion arises just by being aware of our own experience and realizing just innately and intuitively that, oh, this isn't unique to me. This dukkha, or this whatever feeling we have, we recognize, oh, well, this is just human. Oh, everybody must feel this way. Oh, wow. It's interesting. Often I'll find myself, not all the time, but a certain amount of the time, talking about Dharma, finding that I come back to the golden rule. Because this is kind of what this is about, right? So Analio talks about, you know, that just that not to just think about our own viewpoint and the importance of considering others. So I'm gonna read a little bit more. And I was going to say that the last time I was here, my talk used up the entire time, and so I'm going to make sure and leave some time for questions tonight. You can ask me about my last talk. Since I didn't have any time. So here's one of the little pieces that he says about internally and externally. He says, taking the case of anger as an example, how does it feel when I get angry? How will others feel when they get angry? How do I feel when others get angry with me? How will others feel when I get angry at them? Only when we take into account these complementary perspectives do we really understand how painful anger is. I think, and that's a great example to me, to really reflect across all those, to feel like to me, oh, it feels like that to them. And what's it feel like when someone gets angry with me? And seeing that it's painful to be angry, and it's painful to have someone get angry with you. He said, this is further in terms of like how we practice. He says, the instructions first mention the internal and then the external. This gives the impression that familiarity with the contemplated phenomenon is first of all to be established in relation to ourselves before contemplating the same in its external dimension. In other words, the pressing need to bring mindfulness into daily life should not become an excuse for neglecting formal sitting. Just wanted to slip that in. Because I see mindfulness these days is, in the secular world particularly, taught a lot as this external. I mean, aware of yourself, but aware of yourself in the world more than in your daily life. And I think, he makes this point that really the deepening awareness that we get through sitting meditation allows this external awareness to be stronger. Right? Until we really touch that deeply inside ourselves, we kind of don't have that full capacity to be really wide awake to the experience of others. So, a little bit more, and then I'm going to just kind of wrap it up with the general statement. But it says, by shifting from internal to external in our awareness, we increasingly learn to broaden our perspective from seeing only our own subjective viewpoint to taking into account the viewpoints of others. When interpersonal conflicts arise, we learn to be aware not only of our needs, of what we would like to happen, and where we feel we have been wronged, but also of how the situation appears to others. What are their needs? In what ways do they feel they have been wronged? What would they like to happen? More and more, we learn to understand the many ways in which others are impacted by what we do and say. In this way, formal meditation and mindfulness in daily life seamlessly merge, building on the embodied presence of mindfulness. And again, I think this points to the arising of compassion. And this idea of really projecting into what others' experience might be. And of course, we can't know that precisely. But because I think most of us tend to sort of make assumptions about other people based on, based on more stereotypical ideas. Like, for instance, if someone's rich, we might have ideas about them that, like, oh, well, I'm not going to have compassion for them because they've got everything figured out. I think I was talking about this in my last talk, too. This is sort of one of my little pet things lately, because I had a conversation with someone who I consider very bright and really rebelled at the idea that one should be compassionate towards billionaires. And I think we should take all their money, but I also think we should be compassionate as we do that. So it shouldn't be done with anger, but with great love, relieving them of the suffering, the burden of attachment. We so easily kind of turn people into sort of an image or a straw person just based on something about that we know about them, forgetting that whatever outer characteristics they have, whether it's financial or racial or religious or whatever things, sort of how we are defining them, that they're just human. You know, internally, we're all incredibly similar. It's one of the things that I get exposed to a lot of people encountering their inner life for the first time. Particularly the online course I do for Mindful Schools, which is really an introduction to mindfulness. And many people, they think that, as probably everybody here has had this experience to some extent, that when they first start to meditate, they think, oh, like, what's wrong with me that my mind is so busy? And they take it so personally. And it's not understanding that this is just a universal quality, that's what our minds do. And when we start to see that, and when we understand that, there's a big shift in terms of our relationship to our own meditation experience. I hope that you've all had that, and if not, I hope you'll have it soon, that you're not upset about the fact that you're thinking and you're meditating. But also, it's another way that we awaken compassion, because we see, oh, wow, this is difficult. And it's just this basic idea of dukkha, that being a human being is difficult. We have these thoughts that are just not reliable. They don't provide us with what we want them to provide us with. They go off in directions that are not always pleasant, not controlled in the way we'd like them to be. So where Analio kind of takes this is towards the idea of what he calls a comprehensive form of practice, which, as the sutta says, being aware internally, being aware externally, and being aware internally and externally. So that last one is where he's trying to get us to, where we don't see our internal experience as really being something different from external, that we see this as all one sort of experience, that there isn't really a boundary between external and internal, that's actually just an idea that we create. And of course, this corresponds to the idea of interconnection or interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, that we awaken to as we practice, as we start to see that we all have these similar experiences. Then it becomes harder and harder to think of ourselves as really separate from. you know, what are we separate from? You know, it's, there's this sort of physical boundary of the body. We can't really find boundaries of the mind. And the boundaries of our body are just, you know, I'm still always in this world, in this atmosphere. Like, my skin is never separate from air. You know, there's no like sort of DMZ around me. For those who are too young to remember, that means demilitarized zone that we had in Vietnam and I think in Korea as well. But it's like, it's not as if there's like, okay, there's this space of nothingness around me that makes me separate. No, I'm part of this environment. I don't know if that makes sense. It's something that like hit me one time when I was doing walking meditation, that like, oh, you know, yeah, that I'm always touching air. Like, I'm not separate. But this idea of comprehensive practice, then his approach to meditation is very open. He doesn't so much encourage people to pay attention to the breath, but to pay attention to the whole body and feel the whole body and let in sound and to just kind of hold the whole experience. And I think that's a natural kind of, in terms of the evolutionary meditation practice, I think that's a place that many people kind of evolve to. I remember some years ago, not a lot of years ago, I was on a self-retreat, and I called one of my teachers just to have someone to check in. And I kind of was asking him, and this was somebody who was a very experienced meditator, obviously, and very knowledgeable, and I kind of said like something like, well, what do you do when you practice? Like I was describing my practice. And, you know, we don't, because it was sort of a outside of a normal situation, I felt kind of okay to ask him that. I might not, if I'd been at Spirit Rock, I might not like ask a teacher that in a formal interview. But I was on the phone, I was like, well, how do you practice? And he's like, well, and it was kind of like, I just kind of sit and it's kind of open and aware. I don't really focus on the breath that much. I was like, really? Okay. You know, it's kind of that maybe the, I don't know if it's a dirty secret, but I like to say that. So it's the dirty secret that like really experienced meditators don't necessarily pay attention to the breath or even take a single object, but that there's more of this just mindfulness of the mind or mindfulness of the whole experience internally and externally. So I hope that doesn't set up some model in your mind, because that's totally my own guess, by the way. And I actually thought about doing some, towards the end of the Inquiring Mind existence, the magazine, and I had done some editing with them. I suggested, why don't we do an issue where we interview senior teachers and ask them what their meditation practice is? And they're like, I don't know if they'll tell us. And I was like, well, we could do, like, ask them to do it like anonymously, because I don't think they would want to tell you, you know, because again, there'd be a projection. Oh, well, this is the way, you know, Jack Kornfield meditates. I want to, you know, this is the way Gil Fronsdale, this is the way Phil meditates. I want to meditate like that. But I think that, you know, my experience, and I'm sure this isn't true for everyone, but my experience, and it's partly my personality, and each of us has our own kind of feel for how we meditate, but mine is like that I kind of had to grope around for years until it felt comfortable to me, and my practice doesn't quite fit into any of the boxes necessarily. It's more of something organic that arises out of trying a lot of different things and doing a lot of sitting and just kind of trusting the process. And you know, you can't sort of teach that. Because if you say that to somebody who's never meditated before, you just leave them out there hanging, drifting in space. Like, just sit. I was already doing that.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do about that? Which is why when I started to practice, I was really grateful for the very structured practice. I did noting practice, in, out, thinking, hearing, you know. That was great, because basically it gave me something to do. Well, my mind was trying to figure out how to meditate. But anyway, as usual, I digress. But maybe that's a starting point for questions or anything else about this topic I'd be happy to explore. So, you know, when we have the meditative microphone, if anyone wants to say something, ask something.
So when you're talking about the external and just being aware of other people, humor for me works really well.
Humor
works. And I have a beloved person in my life who used to drive me crazy, because when he would drive, he would just get really irritated with people who were driving. And sometimes the things that would happen or be said were, I said, look, I don't want you doing that when I'm sitting in the car. I said, you know, they don't hear this, I'm hearing it. And so, you know, when I would make up, if somebody would do something, I would say, oh, I'm glad I'm not in their hurry. Or then we started making stories about them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
sure.
And the other night we were driving someplace and somebody did something thoughtless in the car. And he was so funny because he just made this great story up about this poor person and why they did what they did.
Right.
And so neither one of us got angry.
That's great.
I just thought, you know, and it could have been true, but I don't know. But like trying to put yourself in that other person's position and not be angry with them. For me, humor really, really helps sometimes with that. So just putting that out there as a possibility.
Thank you. Yeah. I love that. I mean, that's another effect that I remember as I was... when I got through like the first stages of meditation, of just like struggling, and then and nothing had really changed except I wasn't struggling anymore. Like the same thing with stuff going on in my mind, and then I started to find it funny that like you're doing why? What are you doing this for? And it just, the absurdity of the judgments in the mind. You know, the Joseph Goldstein instruction that if you get really caught in judgments, just start counting them. He says when you get to about 500, you'll just start laughing, if not before. Because it's so absurd. Your mind is like a judging machine. It's like cranking them out. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I'm also wondering, this mindfulness of the body internally and externally, if there's any commentary on just the idea of the sensing of beyond the body, which I find fascinating and spend a little time on sometimes.
Yeah.
Is there much commentary on that, or what do you think of that?
I haven't... Analia might refer to something like that, but I remember seeing it. I was kind of going over the things he's written about it. But yeah, you mean that kind of the feeling of kind of the space around you? Like just, yeah, I that's definitely a thing, you know, right? So why not? It seems like a good thing to include in there. I think it's definitely better to do, you know, sort of think both and rather than either or. Because that's right, you know, you can... Well, my sense of emotions is that there's... And there's feels sometimes that emotions are sort of beyond not quite fully in the body. But are you thinking more of like when your eyes are closed and then you realize somebody isn't close to you, or what do you?
Yeah, that could definitely be one too. But I have this sense often of the body being like the just where the skin ends isn't necessarily where the body ends.
Yeah.
That there's a sense of energetic pain.
Yes.
That continues out and then gets lessened and lessened further out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's quite legitimate, and I think, yeah, just as you're kind of pointing to, when you're meditating, your sense of body form can kind of dissolve, and in fact, perception can seem like it's really big or really small, or you know, it's like some parts might seem to be missing, you know, and yeah, there's kind of like just boundarylessness for sure, and I think the mind, especially, you know, this sense of the mind as being sort of boundaryless goes with that. So, yeah, I don't know if there's commentary, but we'll just make our own commentary. Why not? Now that's why I think, why all of the like meditation instructions and like these kind of attempts to sort of categorize everything, at some point it kind of comes up short because you can't. It's not a verbal or even verbalable experience. It's a felt experience, and you know, our minds want to then put it into words or categorize it and say it is this, there's this reality, but I don't know if the reality is that important. It's the felt sense that's important, and obviously people who feel they have psychic powers and things, you know, clearly they are kind of operating in these realms that aren't easily, you know, put in boxes. You know, there's sensitivities.
Yeah. I just want to thank you for validating what you were saying about calling the teacher and him just saying, well, because that's kind of what I do. And I'm in situations where I'm often, there's suggestions made, but I find that the guided thing, I still can walk where I go. It seems to work fine for me, so it's good validation that there's nothing wrong with me or that process.
Yeah.
Trusting that. So, thank you.
Yeah, and I really, to some extent, I don't think you can really progress in your practice if you don't kind of surrender to your own mind. In your own experience, if you're always trying to fit it into, this is what the teacher said to do, and I'm supposed to do, here's the steps that I'm supposed to follow. I mean, that's very helpful in the beginning, you know, a mantra or something, great. But at a certain point, you're faking it, you know, and for it to become real, you kind of have to. The form has to kind of dissolve to some extent, not entirely. I mean, to varying degrees. It all depends, and that can vary. Like I work with form. I try to work skillfully with form. Like when I find like, oh, I'm really just spacing out, then I'll kind of go, okay, breath. You know, come back, be with it, in, out, and really work with it until, because the mind needs to be settled to a certain extent to let go of form. So, you know, you kind of, I think this, and this is kind of the theme of my last talk, was kind of like learning the different strategies for working with different mind states and having different strategies. And you have sort of your most organic form that, or non-form, that works for you. I'm just sitting here, you know. But then you recognize, oh, if you're really angry, you really need to do this. Or if, like, you're really caught up in fantasies, you need to pull back. Or the different ways of navigating it. That's why, to me, you know, it's an art, right? So meditation. It's a beautiful experience because it's so so personal. You know, it's so intimate.
External, and you know, my experience of people in general, well, not in general, specifically, I'm just amazed at the diversity of people and how they relate to the world. I mean, I know people who you can have a conversation for a half hour about a trip to the supermarket, and you know, were the oranges good today, and how are the apples, and, you know, did you meet anybody, you know, and I find myself, when I'm involved in that, very hard to accept that it's judgmental, like, how can you be so involved in such, quote-unquote, trivial things, but I've tried to work very hard to accept that that's part of the human experience. I mean, that is not meditation as far as I can tell, but it's like there's a whole genre or aspect of the world that isn't that way, and those people are not quote-unquote bad people. They're not, you know, ignorant people. That's just their view of the world, and it's the more you look around, or I look around, the diversity of how that is, and in the political world, and the diversity of opinions, and how can they think that way, and you know, it's endless, and I don't know. I'm just talking about, you know, my experiences with this, being aware of things that are so different from the way I think about things, and to somehow accept that and not get caught into the world of judgment.
Yeah. Well, you know, in that particular case, when people are talking about things that seem trivial, you know, one place that I try to go is kind of asking the question, you know, what's going on in this conversation? And because a lot of conversation isn't about the actual things that you're talking about, but it's about being together and sharing and connecting.
Right.
So, you know, certain things, that's why people talk about the weather, you know, because we're all sharing the weather and we're all affected by it. And so, and we just want to talk, and this is something we know that everybody cares about, you know, and so we can kind of connect around it. And yeah, I mean, you know, the New York Times has a section, a food section, and I subscribe to the New York Times, and I can't remember the last time that I read the food section in the New York Times. You know, it just doesn't interest me that much. But clearly, it interests some people a whole lot, because every week they have a whole section on it. The foodies thing. But the point is, like, yeah, when someone's, like, I realized recently I was with my in-laws, and I realized, oh, they're really interested in the domestic. Like, it's about their house, mm-hmm. and their other house, and, you know, the car, and the deck, and the drapes, and, you know, and it's like stuff that I don't care about. Like, I kind of look around my house and go, maybe I should, like, you know, pick that up, you know. Maybe it's not worth the effort, you know. But so I just realized, oh, that's just, they have a different interest from me, but if I want to connect with them, I'm going to talk to them about their house. I'm going to talk about the domestic, right? And that's why, you know, things like sports, you know, you can go into a bar and talk about sport, and you have a thing to talk about. Like, oh, and I used to be on the road with bands back in the 80s, we'd be playing in clubs and hotel lounges and stuff, and I could always you know, bring up just where are you, you know, what part of the country are you in, what are the sports teams, bam, and you're having a conversation. And it's not that I cared about the Kansas City Royals, you know, but I could connect with these people and we could feel comfortable together. So I think it's helpful to just for, you know, for our own comfort to realize, oh, yeah, this is nice, we're talking, you know, rather than, I don't care about the oranges, but I'm going home.
I guess it's an aspect of human existence that we want. We have a need to connect with other people. And
that's for sure.
People connect on whatever subject or topic they can.
Yeah.
And I've had a hard time over time accepting that, but I think I've now accepted that it's okay.
It's okay. There was another hand up. Did you have your hand up? Somebody over here. Okay, the hands keep changing.
So I was thinking about being out in nature and outside as a way of being aware of the body externally.
Externally.
And I was thinking particularly of, I mean, since the last big rainstorm, it's been so beautiful and so fresh. And I, one morning, I took my dog out on the weekend for a walk, and we stopped on this little road into the rock quarry near here where I live. And on one side is this marsh, and it was all filled with water because of all the rain. The other side is a pond, and there were buffleheads and red-winged blackbirds singing and bluebirds. And my dog and I just both stopped and were watching it, but there was a level of connectedness. And anyway, I was just thinking about that in terms of being. So does that fall into the category, or was I just experiencing pleasure?
No, I think that's a really, really great thing to remember, that there's this beautiful world and that it's precious, and to be mindful of it. It's one of the great ways to wake up. I mean, many teachers suggest, you know, spending time in nature. I know Krishnamurti said you should, every day, you should, you know, walk in nature. I think it's a great way to connect with the external. And it's a very, like, integrated experience, because there's this real feeling. It is a place where we kind of sense that we're connected, that we're not separate, we're like part of this thing. It's not just that I'm looking at nature, but I'm actually part of nature. And yeah, if we can even feel ourselves as natural, you know, expressions of nature in our bodies, then kind of having both at the same time. Yeah, thank you.
I noticed in the delivery that when I heard I digress, I thought a switch could be I progress, and then I'm making progress.
Okay. Is that a suggestion for how I should characterize my so-called digressions in the future? Maybe that's a good idea. I progress, therefore I am. Or something. I don't know. I was thinking about just in terms of like how much we can understand without words about what's going on. We went to a movie last night called Arctic, playing at the Albany Twin, which is our neighborhood theater, and it's about a guy who's apparently been in a plane crash. It doesn't even show the plane crash. It's just like, it starts and he's out in the Arctic and there's his plane all crashed up and he's like surviving. It's a survival movie. Probably the amount of words in the film could be cover one page. It's like an hour and a half movie. And it's just, you're just watching him, and you're just watching him go through stuff, and you're like, and of course there's dramatic situations, but even just, you know, his face expresses so much in the way he holds his body. It's another way that we see so much, you know, in another person. We can see so much in them, and we see just from their face, as I talked about Paul Ekman's work, but we also see from somebody's posture. We can tell a lot about what they're feeling, right? And so to start to tune into those things, recognize those things, and then respond to them. It just struck me how you can make an entire movie that's just about watching this person go through stuff, and that we know everything he's feeling. You can see, you know, see every emotion.